Is this? What day is this?
It's Mail It In Friday.
Yeah, well, the dude abides.
This is Overdrive on TSN 1050.
It certainly is Mail It In Friday, because you can already tell that this is not Brian Hayes. But
and it's not Jeff O'Neill.
Well, it's we knew Jeff O'Neill was not coming in today. We knew that Noodles is still on vacation as well. But since I'm filling in for Brian Hayes, the one thing that we can say is a hockey player who's supposed to be in the depth of his offseason, not taking a step into this building, is to my left, Dave Pullen.
There you go. In the building on a Friday. I never looked at it as Mail It In Friday. Like, Friday, to me, was a great day to work because of what was ahead.
The incentive?
Well, yeah, the incentive of the weekend. But until I actually had a regular job, I didn't understand the concept of a weekend my whole life, right? Because weekends were irrelevant. Normally, you are working on a weekend. And in the summer, when you were off, weekends were just the next day. So it was when I first worked, like, toiled in a real job, mm-hmm. that I realized, and it was while I was playing in the summers I worked, and the first Friday rolled around, everyone was all fired up and ready to go, and I'm like, okay, that's what it feels like to be working on a Friday.
So what was your first real job, as you say? You're not counting NHL player.
Not counting NHL player.
As a real job.
As a real job. In the summers, I worked on Wall Street for better part of 7 years.
So that was your first real job?
Yeah.
And that was like during your playing career?
During my playing career. So, like, the first, I had worked, you know, various jobs growing up, but not like a real 9-to-5 job. And my agent, after 2 years in the league, said, you're going to law school, MBA school, or you're going to work this summer, after 2 years in the league. And I said, I'm the captain of the Philadelphia Flyers. We just went to the Stanley Cup Finals. I'm fine, thank you. Mm-hmm. And he said, nope.
So those old tales of, like, Gordie Howe going back to work on the farm and Maurice Richard and all those guys having to work. Dave Pullen had to go to Wall Street and work.
Well, I worked. I wanted to try it. It was something that always intrigued me. It wasn't for me, but I did it with a big firm for almost 4 years. And then we spun off and had a little broker-dealer. But it was always something I wanted to try. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because when you talk to the older players, that first team that I joined in Philadelphia had a lot of guys at the end of their career, particularly from Western Canada, and they said if you didn't make the playoffs back then, you got home first and got the best jobs, and
I got this
you
one
end up
positive.
Making more money than the guys did that were playing in the playoffs,
mm-hmm.
because you had a full summer of whatever job it was you were doing back in Western Canada. So it was kind of funny.
Didn't John Cooper worked on Wall Street, didn't he, before he...
Cooper's a lawyer, I believe.
He is a lawyer.
Yeah.
I know that, but like I think he was working in Manhattan. I could be wrong, but yeah, he was a full-time successful lawyer.
Yeah, I think he was a prosecuting attorney, like,
and then went
for the state
and coached high school hockey, right? Didn't he? That was his.
He did. He was coaching
Notre Dame. Is it Notre Dame?
No, he was coaching. I don't think he coached in Wilcox. I think he was like Bell Tire Midgets, one of the big midget programs in Detroit, in the Detroit area, the Little Caesars and CompuWare and Bell Tire. Those were the big teams, and that's where I first met him. He was coaching those teams, and he would come and work at my hockey camp in the summer. So,
very cool.
Yeah, it's fun.
Well, we joked that it's Mail It In Friday, but our producer, Arad, wasn't mailing it in today because he's lined up a great show. Not only do we have Mark Masters during the first hour of the show, a certain GM who had a successful dinner a few days ago.
He has not taken any time off.
No.
He is not mailing
Flames GM
Friday, Saturday, or Sunday.
Brad Treliving, fresh off of an 8-year deal for Jonathan Huberdeau. So he's going to join us to kick off the 5 o'clock hour.
And nice of him to deliver that, like, last night late, so we have something fresh to discuss today.
I was in the middle of a sports center, and I had heard, like, insiders confirming, like, kind of in the back. I'm like, hold on a sec. What's, like, we're in August.
Thursday night in August.
Yeah, we're reacting to a CFL game and the Jays. But there was that order of business. We're all waiting for Nazem Kadri to sign somewhere. So there is a little...
That's a whole mystery there.
Wow.
And how shocking the New York Islanders are involved in the mystery.
It makes me... Because everyone wants to immediately connect the flames to Nazem Kadri. Who knows if they've even discussed. But the fact that no one has anything on this story makes you think Lou's got to be involved.
Well, you'd like to think that if that's the case, it's done. There's reasonable assurances that it's done. Mm-hmm. I also think there was reasonable assurances that Johnny Gaudreau was signing somewhere else, and those didn't happen. And then, you know, and this could work into the conversation about Jonathan Huberdeau when he watches things like this happen. And if he's got an absolute sure thing in a place that he believes he's going to have a lot of success, and this is about changing your team as well. And there are teams that are looking to change the makeup of their team. And not just, if you're going to change the makeup of your team, you change the makeup of your top players. And clearly Florida just did it, and Calgary has done it. And they've secured that player long-term. So, you know, kudos to Brad Treleving for getting it done. And they're not done. They've got cap money left. They've got, you know, maybe a short order of business in a defenseman that was acquired in the same trade.
Mackenzie Weegar will be a UFA after this season. So there are reports that talks could be happening right now to extend him as well. And so you take away Johnny Gaudreau and Matthew Tkachuk from that team, and you add Jonathan Huberdeau, and you know he's there long-term. Mm-hmm. And Mackenzie Weegar, at least for a year, is there. The Flames, they're not too far off, if at it.
Well, they're different.
They're different. Like, should they have the exact expectations going into the season as they would have with Gaudreau and Tkachuk?
Well, the interesting part is they didn't get by the second round with the team they loved. And so they're different.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you look at it that way and say, how could they break that team up? They didn't get by the second round. And so you look at it and say, are they better? That'll be determined, but they're different. And I think different is good sometimes.
It's funny how
I think it can be good.
Teams can be forced to make these moves. And it can be painful, and it can be emotional. Mm-hmm. And then you look back and go, it was a good thing.
You can't get attached. When you're in management, it's so easy to get attached to players. Because when you know them and they're great people, right. And you know,
maybe you drafted them or you've been scouting them for years.
Yeah, and you know, you go back to when you arguably first met them when they're 17 years old, and when you first interviewed them for the draft, and as we discussed earlier, you home visit them, you meet the parents, you sit in their home mm-hmm. before the draft, and then you draft them, and then they have success, and 10 years later. You meet them somewhere and you have a discussion, you have a different level of
right.
connection to them. You just do. And so, but you can't be attached if you're a manager at the highest level. You simply can't. You're not allowed to be. And you think of some of the moves that Tampa would have made along the way with a Martin Saint-Louis, with you know, guys that they could have easily been attached to, with a Ryan Callahan, you know, that got moved at critical times to make their team better.
Mm-hmm.
And so Calgary is certainly different. They have cap space available. The other factor here is, in moving Gaudreau at left wing, did you open up a top-line slot for Iman Giapane? You know, for a Dylan Dubé? For someone? Do you have someone within the organization who can now elevate to a level that they never would have had the opportunity to elevate to if that spot is full?
Mm-hmm. Does this kind of... I don't want to say save Calgary's reputation, but to steal Brad's words, they took a hit, right?
And they took a hit, and I think it was a very unfair hit, and it was timely because they had two players involved, one becoming an unrestricted free agent, and one becoming, you know, or a year down the road from that. So the timing of that is a little bit out of your control. I think it's a very unfair hit. I do think this goes in cycles as well. Last summer, if you looked at them, where did Blake Coleman decide to sign?
Yeah.
And that surprised everybody. Here's a kid from Plano, Texas, who came up through the national team program in the U.S., American college, had only played in the States, chose to go to Calgary as one of the arguably premier free agents
yeah.
in the market last year.
Got a lot of attention for being on that line with Tampa Bay.
And made the team better when he got there. Yeah. And so I think it was a very unfair hit to a city that, you know, that a lot of people have never been to.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, don't comment if you've never been there and say, you know, how could that be? And it's a great city.
So looking forward to talking to Brad Treleving to kick off the 5 o'clock hour. Keegan Matheson's going to join us a little bit later. He's the Blue Jays beat reporter for MLB.com. They beat the Twins last night in a game where if you're Ross Atkins and Mark Shapiro, you're looking at guys and saying, well, that's why we didn't make a big splashy move, because look who we already have. Vladdy had a big night. Bo Bichette had a big night. Alek Manoah continues to play like he's a 5, 6, 7 year veteran who is built like a truck out there. Like he, I went to his bio, and I don't know how much we can trust the height and weight from bios.
It depends if it's good or it's bad.
Right. But he, according to the bios, he would have 50 pounds on Roger Clemens. Alek Manoah.
And that is amazing.
Right. Because I don't know if that's Roger Clemens from the Boston years when he was a little skinnier. But anyways, like, and when he got hit by that another line drive and he looked at the dugout and said, stand back.
Yeah.
I'm fine. Like, if you're a Jays fan, because, and again, wasn't a gem, but it was another quality start. How can you?
Great start.
How can you not love this guy?
Yeah, no, it was a great start because that's a close game late.
Yeah, I guess the only reason why, because he only went six innings. That may be the only reason why you won't call it a gem. But
you look at the final score and you say, okay, it was a romp. It wasn't at all.
No. And it was a 6-run, 8th inning.
Late runs scored, you know, post him going out. You know, I had a chance to meet Clemens a couple of times, but the first time I met him, we had this time, and the old Boston Garden was so small, and we had this tiny little skate room kind of work area off the locker room, and it was tiny. Mm-hmm. And there was a bench on both sides, and you may have slipped in there, you know, at some point post game to see if anybody was hanging out there. And I slipped in, and there were like three people in the room, and Roger Clemens was sitting up on the bench beside the Gatorade jug. And all I could think about is, and Ray Bourque was in the room, and Ray Bourque was maybe 5'10 and a half, 230. Like, Ray Bourque's base is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And the base of Roger Clemens was that much wider and that much bigger. Yeah. I was looking at his thighs. I was like, this is a ridiculously put together person. And you're looking at Alek Manoah and going, this is a bigger,
yeah,
ridiculously put together person.
Yeah. It's pretty remarkable that he has literally taken the ball and run with it. Like, I still consider him a rookie, even though that he came up and played half of a year last year.
Well, I think you look at his energy and enthusiasm, too.
Well, that, too.
And that's part of it. But at some point in the show, too, I want to get into Springer's role in that.
For sure.
In bringing George Springer here 2 years ago, because he is infectious. When you look at him, the excitement he gets when he gets a base hit, when he gets on base, the excitement he gets for somebody else when he's in the dugout and something happens, I think was a huge factor in management bringing him here 2 years ago.
Right.
For the age team they had and the type of personalities they had, because they had some rock stars at that point, like 21-year-old rock stars. Well, 21-year-old rock stars can go the wrong way.
Absolutely.
In terms of attitude. And now when I watch Bo Bichette and I watch Vladdy Jr. And you watch the way they play the game and the enthusiasm they're playing it with and the, like, they're not on guard like a lot of young, highly skilled athletes are. They're just having fun, and I think Springer's a part of that.
Yeah. And we're all kind of watching every swing, every throw with the elbow injury as well. Like, you need, you know, this team, knock on wood, is going to be in the playoffs as a wild card team. And, you know, they need him healthy. As close as you could possibly ever be to 100% in playoff baseball, you need him there. The position that he plays, where he hits in the lineup, his experience, his success.
Little bit of a pedigree in the World Series?
Yeah, a little bit. Like,
like MVP of the World Series?
Right. It is so important to the young core who, you know, they got a small little taste of what the postseason was like in 2020 when they, because of COVID, expanded things. But, you know, in a real series, and hopefully they're at home for that first wild card series. But before we break to get to Mark Masters, just want to get your thoughts on Whit Merrifield, who made his Blue Jays debut yesterday. And he was the big attention getter at the deadline, not because he's a former All-Star, although that helps, is because he didn't make the trip to Toronto a few weeks ago with the Royals because he wasn't vaccinated. And why would you acquire a guy that wasn't vaccinated? And Ross Atkins, when he did the rounds, didn't say, yeah, he's vaccinated, don't worry. He allowed Whit Merrifield to kind of control that narrative, which he did yesterday, and told reporters, I'll be in Toronto, I'm vaccinated. How do you, like, as someone who's been in, an executive, how do you feel the Blue Jays handled a tricky situation?
I think it was handled very well by both sides, because I think it was a done deal before the trade was made. You're not making
it has to be. Does
you're
it
not making the trade unless you're sure you're getting the player. Mm-hmm. And the only way you're sure of getting the player is if that's looked after. But by letting it develop like it did, it wasn't an ultimatum by any means. Mm-hmm. It may have been before the trade was made, but it wasn't at the critical point. And I think it lets the player start off on a great note the first time he plays in Toronto. And it lets the communication level be at the top level of where it was between player, agent, trading team, and all of the above. And so, and I think he's going to be a really important part. I think this is a critical pickup because of the versatility.
Yeah.
Because of the whole change in the waiver system in 2019, when it used to be there was a trade deadline, but you could put a guy on waivers and everybody would close their eyes and let them go through waivers, and then somebody, and you know, it was chaos. But you could pick guys up. You can't do that anymore with the rule changes. And so you're held to whatever roster you have now. Mm-hmm. And the importance of a guy that can play multiple positions and off to a great start as well, that'll be a confidence booster for him. But if you saw, like at a critical point in the game last night, it's just that it's the, you know, they hit through the infield, the speed to score the run. And he can play, and he can play a lot of different positions, and I think that's really critical, even more so with the way the structure is now. If you're going to have a deep run, you have to have guys like that.
Oh, for sure.
And even age-wise, all of a sudden, he's one of the oldest guys on the team.
Yeah.
You know, at 33. And, you know, and 33, 32. And so, you know, you start looking at the roster, and you start looking at 23s and 24s, and you just think, well...
Yeah. Yeah, and it has speed, and clearly if there's been a blueprint to John Schneider's short tenure as a manager, it's to be aggressive on the base paths, and you need speed, obviously, to do that. But I would find it very interesting to pick the brain of executives of other leagues about the whole the waiver trade deadline that used to happen in baseball and what their thoughts on that were. And how.
Well, it was ridiculous. It really was. I mean, it meant nothing. The trade deadline would come and go, and then the real deadline was August 31st because you had to have them in-house. Right. But even so, there were trades made after that, guys that had huge impacts on pennant runs and only played in September.
Right. Well, and I believe when the Jays back in the 90s acquired David Cohn, that was like the second deadline. And he was obviously a huge part of it.
Like, yeah, and you could use air quotes when you use deadline.
Right, right, exactly. Like, but he got, again, like you say, but they acquired him before December 31st so he could play in the playoffs. But if he had
August
been acquired...
August 31st, yeah.
August 31st. But if he had been acquired in September, it's like, well, we'll get a couple good weeks from you, and then you can ride the pine.
So it can be a factor.
Yeah, so it's be interesting to, or looking forward to talking to Keegan Mathieson at 6:05 with the Blue Jays continuing their series with the Twins. Lots to talk about in baseball right now. Obviously, Toronto is the meat of that. But, you know, we kind of had the carrot dangling at the trade deadline of Shohei Ohtani, the MVP getting traded. The Angels kind of put cold water on that. But it seems like he could be a player move this offseason because the belief is he will not re-sign with the Angels. And if you're that organization, you have to get something for him. And we've never seen a player like him. Everyone goes back to Babe Ruth. I don't even know if that's a fair comparison, but the fact that...
hard to go back to Babe Ruth, really.
Well, right. But even that, like...
go back in name.
He was a pitcher and then a hitter. He didn't really... He kind of did it, you know, he wasn't as big of a home run hitter while he was pitching. Not that I really remember those days too well, but like we all go on currency. You know, well, if you traded this player and he got two first-round picks, he's about the same caliber, so you should get this and this and this. What's the currency?
How do you measure him?
Yeah.
Well, did the availability of Juan Soto change the thought process on moving Ohtani?
Right.
Like, was there enough room?
Like, who has
there?
More value to a team?
But the cloudiness of
the contract
of Soto being on the market.
Yeah.
And him, you know, the knowledge that you knew he was on the market, so you knew there was going to be a deal done, and that was going to take the best deal to get it done. Mm-hmm. Did that take away from Ohtani, and you'd rather have him out there as a you know, is a single entity who is a double entity.
Right.
And but, you know, a deal of that magnitude, you might argue, yeah, well, they just did the Soto deal, but that may be an offseason.
And it wasn't that long ago that a lot of teams would have been reluctant to allow him to do both.
I know.
It took the Angels a lot to really warm up to that idea.
That was his negotiating process coming in, though. He wanted to do both, and there were teams that said, okay, in this day and age, you can't. And
it won't work. And
it works.
Yeah, clearly.
Just fine. Now, looking forward, are you comfortable putting a long-term number on that and saying, okay, it's worked phenomenally for a couple of years?
Right.
But the beauty of it is if one of those two things go, you still have the other one.
Well, exactly. Like, if for whatever reason he throws his arm out and has to have Tommy John, which, by the way, that's worked out okay for Justin Verlander, who's approaching 40 and is going to win a Cy Young this year. But for whatever reason, say he can't pitch the way he has pitched over the last few years. Well, he's still a 40 home run guy.
Or the other way around.
Or the other way, he could still be your
ace. If you just said just pitch.
Yeah. Yeah. My instinct is to say the pitching will go before the hitting.
Will go first.
But what do I know? It's not like I've examined too many of these players. Yeah. Yeah. It's like Verlander again last night against Cleveland. Like that was a guy that a lot of teams. I think I know had reservations towards, and was closest joining the Blue Jays.
Is there a pitcher's name who has been referenced more than Tommy John over the last 25 years?
Tommy John, Cy Young. Those are the first and second.
Because whoever had the Tommy John is usually winning the Cy Young.
Well, the fact that there's, first off, it was this miracle that you could still pitch in the majors after it.
Right.
And for the longest time, you'll pitch, you just won't be the same pitcher. You know, that Verlander is among those who have bucked that trend.
So I wonder if Tommy John now is actually, like, how accurate that surgery is to what the first Tommy John surgery was.
I have to think no.
Zero.
Right?
But they just call it that.
Like, did they have video of that first operation compared to what they're doing now? And you know, simply the tools and instruments that you have in a hospital that you might be able to use today that you didn't back then.
I used to joke with my orthopedic surgeon at Notre Dame, and I'd say, you know, I love you guys. You come out of surgery, and it's like, how did it go? It went really, really well in there. You know, it was really strong. He's going to come back. He's going to be a better player than ever. And I'd say, just once, you think a doctor would come out and say, man, did I have a bad day in there. Like, timing was off, and you know, I just didn't have my game. I didn't have the fastball. And this surgeon used to laugh. It was a golf partner of mine, Freddie Verlich, and he'd say, Dave, it's not like a 60-minute game. I've got as long as I want in that operating room.
There's no clock.
I'm going to make sure I have a good day. Trust me.
For those operations, yes. Have you ever had a player where the surgery didn't go as planned, didn't go maybe as well? Because you always hear from teams, so-and-so had successful surgery.
Yeah, no.
You never hear they had a mediocre operation and fingers crossed we'll see them on the field again.
And there's a reason you don't hear about them?
I'm sure, for multiple reasons.
There are, but absolutely over the years.
Yeah?
No question.
And how, you know, I'm sure as a coach or GM or a president, you're on pins and needles that it does go well.
And there are players that are never the same. Mm-hmm. For a variety of reasons after surgery, they're never the same. Maybe not just the technical part of the surgery.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, maybe the coming back from it, both mentally. Some guys, once they're hurt seriously once, they never play the game the exact same way again for fear of that.
Right. Now they might kind of adapt and still be as effective. But
could be. But it affects guys in different manners. It simply does.
Yeah. Well, as we know, earlier this winter, COVID affected the World Junior Hockey Championship and canceled that tournament while it just got going in Edmonton during the holiday break. It is wild on April 5th to say that in a few days, that tournament will kick off again in Alberta. Mark Masters, as he usually is covering Team Canada for TSN. He is there, obviously, to cover the tournament and how well Canada does throughout that tournament. But obviously, in the wake of what has happened over the last few weeks, you know, the story has changed quite a bit. What is Hockey Canada doing in its infancy in the wake of two investigations from two prior teams? So we'll get into that with Mark. Plus, National Bank Open begins in a couple of days on the tennis front, so we'll get his thoughts on that. The U.S. Open as well. Overdrive continuing. It's Mark Rowe, Dave Poulin, Mark Masters after the break on TSN 1050 and on TSN 4. Overdrive continuing on TSN 1050, the TSN app also up on TSN 4. Mark Rowe alongside Dave Poulin today. Mark Masters, our TSN Leafs World Junior tennis reporter, will join us in a couple of minutes. It is early August, and we are immersed in international hockey, a couple days away from the World Juniors kicking off. And right now, the Hlinka Gretzky Cup is going on in Red Deer. Canada's going to play in the semifinals. I know it's changed a bit over the years in the fact that they do play in North America, but that was a tournament that I know you've been to a lot, and it's got a special place in your heart.
Yeah, it really does. It's the kickoff for the draft this year, and it's the best against the best. So, you know, you have your U18s, and then, but the U18s is sometimes a challenging tournament because you don't get all the players because of the respective league playoffs like that are going hockey, on, yeah, and junior hockey. In the Hlinka, so for instance, in the U.S. national team program, they'll send a hybrid team of their national team program and players who've left to play major junior or somewhere else. And I loved the tournament. And that would have been the first place I would have seen Morgan Riley play in an international sequence. And then he went on to get hurt shortly after that and missed most of his draft year. So that tournament exposure became very important, mm-hmm, to what our thoughts were on him and why we had him number one on our draft board. But it's a great tournament. It sort of kicks off the year. It's in early August, and it was always in Bratislava, which is one of the more gorgeous places in the world. You want to visit there if you haven't. It's absolutely beautiful. It's on the Danube, and it's where the riverboat cruises go through. And so it sort of set the tone in early August, but then you had, you know, 3 or 4 weeks before training camp started, so you could catch your breath again. But in terms of seeing, like, I'm thinking of the, you know, the Tomasz Hertls and the Pasternak's and all the kids that I saw there for the first time against the best competition.
And it, you know, it takes sometimes a special player to be able to play well in the summer when this isn't your natural season, just like it takes a special reporter to perform well in the summer, which is our next guest, Mark Masters. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing very well. Good to be on with you guys.
Pretty smooth segue by him there, right there, wasn't it, Mark?
Wow.
Always is.
Got it.
With Death Row.
Got to tee up my buddy, who's, you're in Edmonton right now, covering Team
Calgary.
Calgary. Tournament's in Edmonton.
Mm-hmm.
Alberta, excuse me. Mm-hmm. How would you describe what the last couple of days and weeks have been like with Hockey Canada and the investigations going on between over two previous teams and taking those next steps as hockey in this country tries to learn from the mistakes from the past years and decades?
Oh, I can imagine it's been uncomfortable. I can just speak from my experience. I've been at a couple of days of the camp they've had here, and certainly the first day with basically all the questions during the media availability being about the fallout and everything that's going on with Hockey Canada right now. And, you know, I think the players eager to turn the page in terms of this year's team. They did a sexual violence workshop the other day for a couple hours, and I was impressed with how the players reacted to that. And talking about what they learned and how they found it to be quite useful. So I think, you know, for this year's team, that's kind of, it is uncomfortable, of course, but they're trying to do their part. I know Mason McTavish said he does feel like this team has a little bit more weight on its shoulders because it's the first World Junior since everything that came to light has come to light. So I'm sure, I guess, maybe the best way to describe it is in terms of the feeling around the team was uncomfortable, and it shouldn't be comfortable considering what's been going on.
Mark, we talk about that, the comfort and the uncomfort, and yet this group is removed from that group by, you know, 4 years. And at that time, I mean, you look back, these were 12 and 13-year-old kids at that point when that was happening, and yet they're responsible for answering to it as well. I saw the Mason McTavish piece. Have most of the players tried to steer clear of it just in terms of absence from it, or, you know, have they been coached a little bit in, hey, let's, you know, answer to it and then move forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone's a bit different. I think for the most part, you know, a lot of the guys are talking about how they still feel like, because a lot of the questions were about how they feel, right, about this tournament, which already has a bit of a different feel because we're in the middle of the summer. And, you know, there's 14 guys back from the team that was there in December. Now there's 9 new guys who are, of course, thrilled for the opportunity to be a part of a team they did not think they were going to be part of. But yeah, I mean, I think that they're saying that, you know, they still have a lot of pride in being here and being part of this process, regardless of what has transpired, while respecting that it is a big story and that there is going to have to be changes that come from it. So it is tough because, remember, they are still teenagers, and these are weighty subjects. So, but I have been impressed with how the players have handled it, because again, it's not easy. You got cameras in your face, and you're searching for the right words, and sometimes they don't exist. So, yeah, that's kind of been my takeaway. I was talking to the women's team because the women's camp is happening right now in Calgary. I'll be going back there today and getting their sense of how they posted a letter last week to Hockey Canada's management and leadership, and you know, they were encouraged with the response they got to that. So everyone's finding their way within the umbrella of Hockey Canada. And, you know, Breanne Jenner talking about how the culture, they're very happy, you know, with the women's team, with the culture that they've built. They think that's one of their biggest strengths, and they're hoping there'll be more women players and representation at the table as Hockey Canada goes through this reckoning they're going through right now.
Mark, going to the women's team on the Canadian side is a natural, I think. Has it trickled to any of the other teams in terms of press conferences yet, or it's still early, I'd imagine, but like the U.S. team answered questions about it or anything like that?
I haven't seen that. I mean, it's quite possible because it's, you know, we're talking about the World Juniors as an event, right? It's every country's putting forward their best, and it's a source of pride for every country. But I haven't seen that. I haven't heard that from the U.S. camp or any other team's camp in terms of them getting questions about this.
Mark, you talked about the timing of this tournament, and you know, you brought up Mason McTavish. It just seems like it was a couple of weeks ago he was playing in the Memorial Cup. How difficult has it been for the players to ramp up that intensity, given the fact that when you represent Canada, there is an immense amount of pressure to win gold at these tournaments?
Yeah, I'm impressed with the fact that McTavish really genuinely is in. He's made this event a priority, because if you look at some of the players that aren't here, and we don't know, everyone has a different approach to the off season, and some guys are dealing with injuries that they've been playing through all season. Some guys are really focused on getting geared up for their NHL, you know, training camp. So when you look at some of the guys who aren't back, Cole Perfetti, of course, with the Jets, he's a guy who's kind of already gone through a full World Juniors and has played pro hockey and is, you know, probably really focused on the Jets right now. Shane Wright just went 4th overall, and he wants to get geared up for the Seattle, you know, training camp there. And so there are a bunch of guys who aren't back. Caden Gooley on defense. Owen Power, of course, is a 1st overall pick, who is, you know, not back. So, but McTavish, and I talked to him, I asked him, you know, what was it like? He's like, there's a lot of give and take with the Anaheim Ducks, but ultimately they decided that it was okay for him to go. They allowed him to go, and he was really happy to be part of this. But if anyone could be tired or might want to beg off, considering the Memorial Cup run he was on, he played in the Olympics, it'd be him. But he's here, he's wearing the C, he's the captain, he's the first line center on a line with Brendan Hoffman and Connor Bedard, his buddy. So that's the first line. It looks like McTavish Bedard could be quite the combination. So McTavish is all in on this, and the guys that I've seen skating, they seem like, you know, even though you're getting geared up in the middle of the summer for a high level tournament, they seem like they have a lot of energy, which I guess is part and parcel to a lot of these guys have had some time off. So I think the hockey will be good. Maybe they won't be quite as locked in as they would be in the middle of the season, but they should be, a lot of them, fresh.
You know, Mark, when I came back to Canada in 2009-10, I was even surprised by the magnitude of this tournament at Christmas. And, you know, I had been in the States and I was involved in college hockey where some of my players would go, you know, to compete in it. But because it wasn't televised down there on as much magnitude and everything, I was stunned by how big the World Junior tournament was in the community. Do we lose that a little bit because it's not the day after Christmas with the first game and families all being together? And, you know, so many people tell me this is the start. This is when they start their kids on hockey and international hockey, is at Christmas time with the World Juniors.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's gonna feel different for sure for a lot of reasons. It's impossible to know exactly what it's gonna be like once we get into Edmonton when the team moves up there, which they have a pre-tournament game. I believe it's Monday, so we'll be heading up Sunday night to Edmonton, and so usually there's a different feel once you get to the actual city and get settled, but everything is so associated with the holiday season and Boxing Day and New Year's Eve and all that. There's a lot of the stuff with the World Juniors that is associated with the calendar, so I don't know what it's going to be quite like. I still think it's going to have some magnitude, because every time you're at a World Juniors and you have a chance to win a gold medal, but even, you know, Russia not being part of it this year, there's a lot of reasons why it's going to feel different, and I honestly have no idea what to really expect considering everything that's gone on from the atmosphere. I know in December, you know, because of COVID-19 and the Omicron variant, like, we only had, I think, half capacity, and even then it wasn't entirely full, I don't think, so there was a weird vibe there too. So I'll be intrigued to see. You know, that's definitely one of the storylines going into this tournament, just exactly what the atmosphere, what the feel is going to be like for World Juniors in the middle of the summer.
Joined by Mark Masters, who, of course, is our World Junior reporter, but he's also our tennis reporter. The National Bank Open begins next week in Toronto and Montreal. The U.S. Open is around the corner. And, you know, last night I was watching Felix Auger-Aliassime win his quarterfinal against Steve Johnson. So he'll play in the semis in Mexico later today. And it made me think just of the career arc of Felix. And you know, you can add Dennis in. You can add Bianca, Layla. You've been there from, what, they were 14, I think. Like, do you ever get those moments where they obviously still want to aspire to do more, but you're seeing them realize this potential of really kids that you first saw, you know, close to 10 years ago?
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's been one of the best parts of covering tennis in this last little bit, has been seeing the growth of these guys. I mean, I was my first Grand Slam was 2014, and it was because Jeannie Bouchard and Milos Raonic were doing so many great things on the scene, but I didn't see them coming up. I knew the story, obviously I'd seen them play, but I hadn't covered them on the way up, and that's what's made this so much fun and really enjoyable, is to cover, you know, Bianca and in her junior Grand Slams, and, you know, Dennis won Wimbledon, and Felix won the U.S. Open and you were there for that, I believe, right? Or, yeah, so I had a chance to see him in semifinals and in the junior runs, just building them their way up. So it's been fun to see that, and now they're at that next stage where they're trying to, you know, certainly on the guy's side, Dennis and Felix trying to, you know, break through and win a Grand Slam. Bianca's done that, but now trying to get back. So it's the journey is what makes it so exciting in sports, I think, right? You're invested. You see the young players or a young team, you know, knock on the door and then break through, and that's what makes it, I think, sports so great. So for me, that's been definitely a satisfying part of being part of covering tennis in this country over the last few years, for sure.
Which Canadian going into the final major of the year do you have the biggest expectations for?
Wow. It's really tough to say now, right? Mm-hmm. Because Leila Annie Fernandez is coming off an injury, so it looks like she'll be good to go in Toronto, I hope. But that's not easy coming off a stress fracture in her foot. Bianca, we got this lower back thing that plagued her out in San Jose. But we know that on the hard courts, she can be as tough as anyone. So that's on the woman's side. And then on the men's side, Dennis is in quite a rut, right? He's lost 8 of 9, so that's tough. I saw he's got Alex de Minaur in the first round in Montreal, so that's not going to be easy. And then I guess you'd probably say Felix, even though it hadn't been the easiest run until this week after Wimbledon, losing the first round of Wimbledon, losing the first round of Newport. But he's having a good run in Mexico. We'll see how he does against Norrie tonight. But probably if you had to pick someone on the tennis side right now for Canada that you had the most confidence in, to go on a deep run in the U.S. and U.S. Open, and probably say Felix, and then I reserve my right to reevaluate this when I see the help of Fernandez and Andreescu.
Yeah, I think Layla has got to be the wild card just with the foot injury. But going by her training videos, she looks good. Mm-hmm. I know that you'll probably get an update from Jorge in a few days or so. So we're looking forward to that. Also, looking forward to your World Junior coverage as always. The only thing better than Mark Masters covering the World Juniors during the holidays, in the middle of the summer, apparently. Whether you like it or not, my friend.
Yeah, it's fun. It's a different feel, that's for sure. It's a different vibe walking into an arena in the middle of the summer and having to get geared up for games of this magnitude. So I'm ready. I'm locked in. You know, I had COVID, obviously. A lot of people did at the World Juniors in December. So it's some unfinished business to come back and see if we can't see it through this time.
I bet. Well, we appreciate you joining us, and good luck in Alberta covering the World Juniors.
Thank you. Anytime.
Okay, there you have it. Mark Masters, our Leafs World Junior tennis reporter, joining us here on Overdrive. World Juniors in August.
Yeah, it's a different feeling, and you go to these summer tournaments, and you're in shirt sleeves, but you have a jacket draped over your arm because the rink has to be at some temperature of cold.
Right.
And, you know, I've done it all over, literally all over the world.
I loved also, I don't know if you saw during the broadcast, they showed all the scouts at Canada's last game against Sweden, and all the veteran scouts or GMs, like Sheveldayoff and Yzerman, and they're just watching.
Hextall was in there, too.
Hextall. And Jason Spezza, the new assistant GM, he's like you. He's writing a textbook.
You know what? He's a smart man. And, you know, when you go to those for the first time, it's so overwhelming because you're seeing all these kids for the first time. And there's a certain patience when you're a Stevie Yzerman or a Ron Hextall or a Kevin Sheveldayoff that, first of all, it's not your principal job to know every single person. Mm-hmm. And that's brilliant because Jason's going to, right now, he's thinking that he has to know who the left winger is on the third line on Czechia.
This is great video.
In case he gets asked. It's a brilliant video. Yeah. But I also respect that so much because he's not doing a job. He's doing a job.
Yeah.
Oh, like, he thinks that in the next meeting, somebody's going to ask him a question, and he is going
to
know the answer.
That's great to see.
It's terrific.
I would never want to think that he would take that position lightly, but he is certainly jumping in, you know, full steam ahead.
But I think some do take it lightly when they first get into it, and then they become absorbed by it. Right. And, you know, by all accounts, he is a hockey, and I say this very, you know, respectfully, a hockey nerd, where he knows the history of the game, and he studies it. And he looked like a rookie scout there, and that's what I would want a rookie scout to look like.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I want him to look like. Thumbing through the pages and saying, okay, there's a number 19 in there, and I know I know I saw him, and I know I liked him, but, you know, and that's all. And when I went in to those tournaments for the first times, I'd like to go in blind, and I like to go in and not be told who the best players were in the respective teams and just watch. And sometimes I would say, you know, and then I'd go back and look at the notes that were submitted beforehand by the local scouts and say, well, where's number 17? Like, why am I not? And then they'd say, oh, he's a triple underage. And I'd say, okay. Yeah. So he's not due for three more drafts, in other words.
Well, the Hlinka Gretzky Cup wraps up this weekend. Then the World Juniors begins. Maybe Spezza will be in the crowd for that as well, writing away on a new textbook.
Well, but he could be looking at a player that no one said a word about, and it's Alexander Barkov, who was on left wing on the U18s when he was 15.
Yeah.
And you're looking at him going, why is nobody talking about the big kid playing the left wing?
That's a great point.
So I really respect what Jason's doing, and he'll be very good at what he does.
Maybe Brad Treliving will be at the World Juniors. The Flames GM is going to join us at 5:05, literally less than a day after signing Jonathan Huberdeau to an 8-year deal. So we'll get his thoughts on that as Overdrive continues on TSN 1050, the TSN app, and also up on TSN 4. Wrapping up the first hour of Overdrive on TSN 1050, the TSN app, also up on TSN 4. Mark Rowe in for Brian Hayes alongside Dave Poulin. At 5:05, Flames GM Brad Treliving is going to join us as we discuss a lot of things, but obviously the main topic is Jonathan Huberdeau signing an 8-year deal, $10.5 million a season. So any possible issue hanging over this team of like, this is simply a rental is gone. And for Huberdeau, I don't know how much he had to be sold on the Flames and Calgary, but whatever happened over the last few days clearly went well, and he was convinced.
I wrote the word scarred down as in, you know, was Calgary scarred by what went on?
Mm-hmm.
But then when I took one R out of that word, it became scared. And if you're a player and you're in the market right now, you might wake up at 3 a.m. with your eyes wide open thinking, what if there isn't a team for me? What if there isn't a contract for me? What if there isn't, you know? And so how much of the uncertainty weighed in here with a player like Jonathan Huberdeau, who said, you know, if I've got a situation that I think is going to be really good and the offer's on the table, you know, it's my security, it's my generational money, and I'm going to accept that, and I'm going to have a great, great run in Calgary. So a lot of different factors weigh in here.
So looking forward to talking to Brad to kick off the 5 o'clock hour. TSN 1050 is delivering backpacks filled with school supplies, supporting local families during these difficult times. It's all part of the Back to School Backpacks event happening August 24th. This year's event is presented by Vanilla Prepaid, available for purchase at Petro-Canada, together in partnership with the Children's Breakfast Club's 1,010 young students will receive the tools they need to succeed before the school bell rings in September. For all the details, head to tsn1050.ca.